MFO Medford. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there is no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Pre-recorded.
Thank you, Digital Henry. Good morning. It's the 7th of July, 2020. My name is Arthur, and this is the Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. I'm going to have a Jack Webb double feature today. For the first half of the show, I'm going to play Dragnet, The Big Flight. This had an original air date of the 17th of November, 1953. Although I don't know if it was on its regular network or this was the Armed Forces Radio Service broadcast. But oh well, here it goes. Thanks for listening.
Dragnet.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned a robbery detail. Three holdup men have robbed and beaten two supermarket operators in your city. You've got a good description of the thieves. Your job, get them.
It was Tuesday, November 3rd. It was cold in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of robbery detail. My partner's Frank Smith. The boss is Chief of Detectives Thad Brown. My name's Friday. We'd gotten a hot shot call about a robbery, and it was 9:46 a.m. when we got to the corner of Lockwood and Barton Avenues. The Lockton Market.
Officer back there.
Yeah. Friday and Smith, Central Robbery.
Oh, yeah. I'm Jackson, Unit 3A7.
You answered the call?
Yeah. We got here a couple of minutes ago.
Where's the victim?
Back room there. He's pretty bad off. Ambulance attendants with him now.
Mm-hmm.
My partner's checking the neighborhood. If there's nothing you need me for, I'll give him a hand.
Yeah, make a 211 report before you leave, will you?
Right.
Thank you.
Looks like there was quite a fight.
Yeah, stuff all over the place. Come on.
What do you got in that bottle? It sure stinks.
Yeah, you gotta clean up these cuts. I'll try to hold still.
Ow!
Hey, take it easy, huh?
Yeah, something you want?
We're out of Central Robbery. Is this the victim?
Yeah, a couple of cuts, nothing serious.
Tell him about Andy. He's the one who really got it.
Who's Andy?
Yeah, the clerk. Pretty rough. Looks like it might be a fractured jaw. He's in the truck now. Now, let me get this tape on you now, huh?
Ow!
That should do it. Might be a good idea if you saw your doctor.
Yeah, what about Andy?
We're going to take him down to Georgia Street Receiving.
You going to call me and let me know about it?
It might be better if you called them.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, I see you guys, huh?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, sure.
Boy, that one guy really clouded me. Hurt.
Mm-hmm. Wonder if you feel up to telling us what happened here.
Three of them. Three. Came in and held up the place, clouded me and Andy. Sure hope he's going to be all right.
What's your name, sir?
Cliff Hall.
You own the store, do you?
No, me and Andy run it, though. We'd like to buy it.
What time did these men come in?
Must have been around 9:30, around in there.
Did you give the officers who answered the call a description of the men?
Yeah, that was the first thing they asked me.
Go ahead, please.
I was getting the money ready for the bank deposit. Andy was back here stacking bottle cases. These three guys came in. First off, I thought they were customers.
Yeah.
A couple of them walked to the back of the place. I thought they were picking out stuff. The other one kind of stood around by the cash register where I was.
Go ahead.
Well, after he was there for a minute and I see the other two aren't picking up nothing, I asked him if there was something I could get for him. That's when he pulled out a gun.
What about the other two?
All worked like they had some kind of signal. As soon as the one in front pulled his gun, the other two did, too. The fellow asked me to put all the money in a paper bag. Got the bag from up in front there. Took it right out of the stack and handed it to me. Said for me to put the dough in it.
You recall his exact words?
What?
The way he said it. The words he used. You recall them?
Let me see. I think it was, put all the dough in this bag. Don't say anything. Just do as I say. That was the way he said it.
What'd you do then?
Like he said. He had that gun pointed right at me. I could see the other two guys. I wasn't going to do anything but what he told me. I put the money in the bag.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they'd leave the place, but that's when Andy came out. I guess he wondered what the other two were after. You see, from where he was, he couldn't see the guns.
Yeah.
He walked out to them, asked if there was anything special they were looking for.
Mm-hmm. What happened then?
Well, then he saw what was happening. saw the guns and he tried to throw the guys out. I don't know why he did it. Andy's like that. He gets an idea in his head and there isn't anything that'll shake it loose. He tied into those two guys, almost had him whipped, too, even with the guns. The guy that was with me saw what was going on and yelled back at him, told him not to shoot. He ran back and laid his gun alongside Andy's head. Oh, clouded him right along in here.
Mm-hmm.
Andy dropped like a sack of potatoes and the three guys ran out of the store.
How much money did they get, you know?
I hadn't finished up with a bank statement yet. I'd just be guessing, but I'd say about $8,000. Might run to $8,500, but that's about it.
I see. Now, if you could just give us a description of the man.
All three of them?
If you could, yeah.
The one who was with me must have been about 5'11", kind of dark complected, had straight black hair.
What color were his eyes?
Brown.
You have any marks or scars you could see?
No.
Clean shaven?
Yeah, I had a real dark beard. Looked kind of like he had some kind of talcum powder on.
Do you remember how he was dressed?
Let's see. A dark blue suit, gray top coat, gray hat.
Was he wearing a tie, do you know?
Yeah, a gray tie with maroon stripes. You know, kind of diagonal, a thin tie.
Anything unusual about him? Make it easier for us to identify him?
No, I don't think so.
How about the gun he was carrying? What kind was it?
I couldn't see the name.
No, sir, I mean, was it an automatic or revolver?
Oh, an automatic. Looked like a big caliber, I'd say 45. One of the other fellas had a revolver, but the guy with me and the small one had automatics.
You know if they drove a car?
Well, if they did, I didn't see it. Might have had it parked right out in front, for all I know. I told you I was busy when they came in. When they left, I was too worried about Andy to pay any attention to him. The way they hit him, a terrible thing, right along here. Oh, excuse me a minute. I got some aspirin here in the drawer.
Yes, sir.
Sure hope Andy's going to be all right. We've been together a long time. Can't get over that little guy, the one who hit me. I should have taken him. But the big one, he's tough looking, a real fighter.
Well, this isn't going to help much.
Huh?
He's going to lose this one. We got the descriptions of the other two men, and a supplementary local broadcast was gotten out. The two officers who'd answered the call found a woman in the neighborhood who'd seen three men leave the vicinity immediately after the robbery. She said that she was parked in a car half a block from the store on the same side of the street. She explained that about 9:20 a.m., a car had pulled into a parking place in front of her. She'd seen three men leave the car and walk down the sidewalk in the direction of the Lockton Market. About 10 minutes later, the men came back to the car. They appeared to be in a hurry. One of the men was upset and arguing with the other two. She told the officers that they'd gotten into the car and driven off toward Hollywood Boulevard. We asked her to describe the three men. The description she gave us matched the one we'd gotten of the thieves. She gave us a description of the car, and another supplementary broadcast was put out. We asked her to come down to the city hall to go through the mug books to see if she could give us a positive identification. The report from Georgia Street Receiving Hospital indicated that the victim of the slugging, Andrew Rich, was suffering from a fractured jaw and a concussion. He was given emergency treatment and removed to the county hospital. The crime lab crew came out and they went over the store for physical evidence. They were able to lift three partial fingerprints from the counter next to the cash register. Dean Bergman and Leighton Prince explained that the partials were not enough for identification, but that if we apprehended the holdup men, he'd be able to tell us if they'd left the impressions. 10:27 a.m., we took the victim Clifford Hall and the woman who'd seen the car to the mug room. They went through the mug books, but they were unable to come up with an identification. We had the stats office make a run on the M.O. They came back with a list of 17 names of men who at one time or another had used the same method of operation. The list was split, and Sergeants Meade and Leitner worked with us in checking the names out. Thursday, 3:48 p.m., Frank and I got to the sixth name on our list.
Jerry Evanston, that right?
Yeah.
Sure dark in this hall. He ought to wash the windows, let some light in.
Yeah, here we are.
Why not be in?
Yeah, we'll try it again. Now let's talk to the manager.
Yeah.
Yeah? Who is it?
Manager, we want to see you a minute.
Just a minute. What do you want, us to sleep?
Come on, Evanston, open up.
Now, we can get out of here.
Police officer.
Come on. Watch it, Joe.
All right, come on, Evanston, get up.
What are you doing, McLean? Look, you got no right to come busting in here like this.
Yeah, you're so clean. What are you putting that trouble for?
I got scared, that's all. I just got scared. Well, how'd you feel if somebody woke you up and then shoves their way into your room? You ain't gonna stand around and just let them do it.
He's clean, Joe.
I told you that. Look, I got no trouble. I don't want none. You check with Galloway. He'll tell you. I'm home every night at 9 o'clock. Every night.
Where were you this morning?
Huh?
This morning, where were you?
What time?
You just tell us what you did, starting when he got up.
I was up all night. I got a virus or something. I couldn't sleep. Take a look there in the dresser. You can see the stuff I've been taking. I haven't been out of this room, not for a couple of days.
Can you prove that?
Why?
Can you?
No, there wasn't anybody here.
You get any phone calls?
No. I don't know what this is all about, but you guys are leaning on me for nothing. Now, you talk to Galloway. He'll tell you. I've been working. Well, look here. I'll show
you. Where are you going?
I just want to show you something I got in a drawer.
Well, you stay right there. I'll get it for you.
Okay, I got nothing to hide. Take a look in the top drawer there, left-hand side.
Yeah. These what you mean?
Yeah, that's it. Now, take the rubber band off and look. You'll see I'm telling you the truth. Now, you see? It's all the check receipts I've gotten from where I work. You look at them. I'm working every day, and I'm home at night, 9 o'clock every night.
How about it, Joe?
Yeah.
Now, you see?
You haven't been out of this room all day, huh?
Not a minute. Now, come on, what's all this about anyway? What are you guys after?
We figured maybe you could tell us.
Yeah? Well, I'm sorry. Without you telling me what you want, there's nothing I can give you.
You see any of the boys anymore?
You mean the fellas I knew before I fell?
That's right.
Not if I can help it. I'm trying to stay away from them.
See any of them lately?
Yeah. Saw Alex a couple days ago.
Alex?
Yeah. Alex Finley. I knew him when I was up in Q. He came in where I was working.
Did you talk to him at all?
All right. Just said hello. Passed a couple of minutes talking about some of the guys we know.
See in the rackets now?
I don't know.
Is he on parole?
Yeah, I think so.
Did he give you anything?
Oh, a couple of rumbles, but if I turn them over to you, I don't want a credit for them. You don't know where you got them.
All right.
Alex tells me there's a gang that's going to start working here in town, market jobs.
How many men?
Well, from what Alex says, there's four, all heavy guys.
Finley with him?
No, I don't think so. He told it to me that he just heard it.
Did he say anything about who the four men are?
No, I don't think he knew. He just said they were heavy and they were starting to work.
You know where we can get in touch with Alex?
No. Well, you might check with Galloway at the parole office. He might have it.
Yeah, we will.
I'll probably see him again. I'll try to get the information if I can. Well, what is you want to know? Who the guys are?
That's right.
Okay. Now, like I told you, though, I don't want any credit for it. I'm in real trouble if it gets around that I'm playing footsie with you.
Yeah, sure.
I'll try to find out when they're going to start working, too.
Well, don't you worry about that.
Huh?
We already know that. 4:10 p.m. We got in touch with Fred Galloway at the state adult parole offices, and we checked on Jerry Evanston. From what the record showed, the story Evanston had told us was true. His parole officer had reported him working and apparently living up to the conditions of his release. We left him one of our cards and asked him to call us in the event he heard from Alex Finley. 4:21 p.m. We checked back into the office and we met with Sergeants Meade and Leitner. They told us that they'd checked out the names on their half of the list without result. We sent a teletype up to George Brereton, CII Sacramento, giving him the description of the holdup men and listing the M.O. that they'd used. We asked him to run the information through their files and forward any information they came up with. 5:19 p.m. We went out to get something to eat, and then we checked back into the office.
Good dinner, huh, Joe?
Yeah. I never saw a guy could eat so many enchiladas as you.
Nah, I can't help it. I get started on them, can't seem to stop.
Yeah.
You got any soda in your locker?
No, you got trouble again?
You know I always do when we have enchiladas.
You ought to remember that when you order a half a dozen.
I suppose so.
Yeah, I get it. Robbery Friday, yeah. When was that? They're pretty sure, are they? Has the lab been called yet? Yeah. Okay. Right, thanks. Oh, that's a break.
Yeah?
They just found the getaway car. p.m. We left the office and drove out to where the car had been found. It was parked on Lockwood Avenue, 5 blocks from the market that had been robbed. The radio car officers had spotted it, had called the office immediately when they saw a brown paper bag in the back seat bearing the printed name Lockton Market. A crew from Leighton Prince came out and went over the car. They were able to come up with a single print from a man's index finger. Bergman compared it with the partials found at the market. They matched. We checked the white slip in the car and found that the vehicle was stolen. The report on it had been filed at 10:37 a.m. that morning. We talked with the people in the immediate vicinity, but none of them were able to tell us anything about the people who'd parked the car. However, we did come up with an elderly man who told us that he'd seen three men get into another car at about 9:45 that morning. He said that he remembered it because the driver of the car had pulled into a parking space and stopped the motor. Another automobile had parked directly in front of the car, and the driver of the first machine had moved so that there was no one in front of him. The man went on to say that a few minutes after the driver pulled into the second parking place, three men had come around the corner, gotten into the car, and the four of them had driven off. The witness was unable to give us a description of the car other than to say that it was a late model Plymouth or Ford. The only description he could give us of the men was that one of them was large and was wearing a gray top coat and a hat, and that one of them was small. 8:40 p.m. Frank and I went back to the office and checked out for the night. The following morning at 8:02 a.m., I checked back in for work.
Hi, Joe.
Morning. Kind of cold out.
Yeah.
You look happy this morning.
I didn't sleep a wink last night, Joe. Not a wink.
What's the matter?
Stomach. Next time I even think about eating enchiladas, stop me, will you, Joe?
Yeah, sure. Any mail come in?
I don't know. I just got in.
There's an ad here from that store over on West 6th. They're having their annual sale.
Yeah? I want to try to get over there. I'd like to get me a new suit for Christmas.
There's a special delivery from Brereton.
Huh.
Probably those mugs we asked for. I'll see. Yeah, there's six of them. You want to get in touch with Cliff Hall? You can drive over and have him take a look at them.
Yeah. You got any other pictures?
Yeah, we can mix them up.
I'll call Hall.
Okay.
I sure hope we get an ident. We haven't got much to go on. Well,
there's got to be a break someplace. We got to find it.
From what Finley said about the gang starting up operation, doesn't sound like just one job.
No.
They start on a string, they can do a lot of damage.
No, it doesn't give us much choice, does it?
No.
We got to get to them. 8:27 a.m. Frank and I left the office and drove over to talk to the victim, Cliff Hall. We showed him the mugshots George Brereton had sent us. He picked one out and said that he was positive that the man in the picture was the one who'd held him up. The name on the mugshot was Harold Bishop. According to the record Brereton had sent us, Bishop had been convicted twice on violation of 211 PC, armed robbery. 9:20 a.m. We drove over to the county hospital and showed the pictures to the other victim, Andrew Rich. He picked the mugshot of Bishop as the suspect who'd robbed and beaten him. The notation on Bishop's picture gave us the information that he was on parole at the time. We returned to the office and put in a call to Fred Galloway at the State Adult Parole Office.
Yeah, Fred, this is Joe Friday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fine. We'd like some information on a Harold Bishop. San Francisco number 826-09. 26, that's right. Male, white, Caucasian. We got a mug from Brereton. No, he says he's on parole. Yeah, if you will. Thanks a lot. He's checking the master file now.
Mead and Lightner are standing by if we need them.
When we get this address, we're going to have to move fast.
Yeah.
Yeah, Fred. When was that? Well, how's his report there? I see. No, I don't know. Yeah, I suppose. Right, Fred. Thank you. Well, you can tell Mead and Lightner to relax. Bishop's got an out-of-state parole. He's living over in Phoenix.
Well, he still could be getting into California.
No, not likely.
Huh?
Fred checked with his parole officer.
Yeah.
He's got a job, and he's been reporting to his parole officer every month. We asked Fred Galloway at the state parole office to contact Bishop's parole officer in Phoenix and check him closely. The report came back that the suspect had a job with a small contractor and that he'd been working regularly. He'd also been giving monthly reports to his officer. We'd had a suspect identified by two of his victims, and yet if the information we'd gotten was correct, it would have been a physical impossibility for him to have committed the robbery. We got a copy of his jacket and looked over his past record. We found that Bishop had been arrested for armed robbery the first time 18 years previously. He'd been brought to trial and acquitted. The next arrest was 10 months after his trial. He'd been convicted and served 6 years at San Quentin. He'd been released, and within 6 months, Bishop had been picked up again. This time, he was sent to Folsom Penitentiary. While he was there, he appeared to be a model prisoner, and after serving 4.5 years, he'd been placed on parole. After leaving the prison, he'd requested and he'd been granted an out-of-state leave. In checking Bishop's M.O., we found that it matched exactly that of the thieves who'd held up the Lockton Market. The time of approach was the same, the number of men used was the same. The method of leaving the scene was exact. We had a suspect, and yet he couldn't have committed the crime. 3 weeks passed. On Saturday, November 26th, the thieves hit again. In checking with the victims, they identified the mugshot of Bishop. We put in a long-distance call to the Phoenix Police Department and asked them to check on the suspect. We got word back that he was in their city. They told us that he wasn't at work due to a virus infection. They went on to say that they'd checked with his landlady and that she told them that Bishop hadn't left his apartment at all on the day of the theft. Monday, November 28th, we got our first break in the case.
I'll get it. Robbery, Smith. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Jerry. Uh-huh. You sure about that? Where? Uh-huh. How about the rest of them? Yeah, just a minute. Toss me that pad, will you,
Joe?
Yeah,
here you go.
Okay, Jerry, go ahead. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you spell it? L-A-L-E-A-H-Y? Uh-huh, I got it. Mm-hmm. You know the address? Yeah. Okay, thanks, Jerry. We'll get in touch with you. Right. Jerry Evanston, remember the guy we talked to over on South 7th?
Yeah.
Well, the way he tells it, we aren't too far off.
How do you mean?
He saw Bishop in town last Saturday.
We put in a call and we found that there were two major airlines with flights to Phoenix. The flight time they listed was 1 hour and 35 minutes by air. If Bishop caught the last flight leaving Phoenix, he could arrive in Los Angeles at 11:20 p.m. the night before he planned to commit a robbery. The next day after the holdup, he could catch a plane from the Los Angeles International Airport that would have him back in Phoenix at 8:25 p.m. By doing this, he would be absent from his work only one day, and he could schedule his flight so as not to hit on the days when he had an interview with his parole officer. Tuesday, November 29th, a meeting was held in Chief Thad Brown's office. It was decided to put a special stakeout on the airport and wait for the suspect to come into town. At that time, he'd be followed and taken into custody as he prepared to commit another robbery. The names of the three other men Jerry Evanson had given Frank as having been involved in the holdups had been checked through R&I. All three of them had arrest records. Surveillances were placed on their homes, and they were kept under constant watch. Monday, December 12th, 11:15 p.m., Frank and I relieved the stakeout at the airport.
There's a bench over there. We can keep all the gates in view.
Yeah.
Wonder when he's going to hit again.
I don't know. The last couple of weeks have sure dragged by, haven't they?
Yeah. Anything on the other three guys?
Well, I talked to Pinky Meade this morning. He and Leitner staked out at Leahy's apartment.
How they doing?
Nothing. Parked in the car down the street. From what they say, Leahy's like a clock. He comes in at 5 a.m., leaves at 9 p.m. every day. You got a cigarette?
Yeah. Here you go.
Thanks.
Joe.
Yeah. Bishop. Let's let him get outside.
Yeah. Wonder if he's got any luggage.
Well, they bring it up outside. We can wait for him there. All right, come on.
You see him?
Yeah, there he is. Getting into that cab. Come on. Frank and I got in our car and followed the cab taken by the suspect. We followed him out of the airport grounds and then up La Brea Avenue. The cab turned right on Washington Boulevard and headed for downtown Los Angeles. We pulled up to a stoplight.
Still got him?
Yeah, he's still up ahead in front of that blue Mercury. See him?
Yeah. You got the number of the cab?
Mm-hmm. 2974.
There's the light.
All right, let's go. Better try to pick it up a little, Frank. Cab's pulling away from us.
Yeah. Think he's seen us?
No. Can't you close in a little?
Traffic's too heavy. Can't use a siren. We'll tip him.
Yeah.
Still see him?
Yeah. There's a brake. Guy ahead's making a right turn. Now we're right behind the cab.
Yeah. I'll close in now.
Good. Watch it, Frank. That guy pulling out of the alley.
Hold on.
As we drove down the street after the stoplight had changed, the car had failed to make a boulevard stop coming out of an alley, and we'd hit it broadside. The damage done to both cars was considerable, and we'd lost our suspect. Frank got to a phone and called the office. He gave them the number of the cab that Bishop was in and asked for a traffic investigation car. The office started a search for the missing suspect. Lieutenant Jack Smyers told us to proceed to the apartment of Tom Leahy to wait for further development. In the meantime, a citywide broadcast went out carrying the description of Bishop and the other three men involved in the theft. Frank and I arrived at the apartment and we relieved Meade and Leitner. We had the manager of the place let us into Leahy's room. We waited. 1:30 a.m., 2:30, 4 o'clock, 5:30 a.m. Frank and I had been on duty for over 21 hours. At 5:45, the phone in the apartment rang once and then it quit. That was the arranged signal between us and the office. Frank put in a call. Lieutenant Smyers told us that officers Max Herman and Ed Benson were on the way out to relieve us. 15 minutes later, we heard somebody in the hall.
Joe?
Yeah, it's probably Benson and Herman.
Yeah.
I'll get it.
Watch it,
look
Joe.
Look out, the gun.
Give it up, Bishop. You all right, Joe?
Yeah, come on.
He's going upstairs.
Making for the roof. Come on.
You see him?
No. You want to take that side?
Right.
Watch it.
Behind the elevator shaft, Joe.
Yeah, I see him. You're in trouble, Bishop. Don't build any more for yourself.
I got nothing to lose. They nail me again. I'll be up at the joint for life. Don't cost no more to kill you.
There's no way off this roof, Bishop. Throw that gun out here and you follow it.
You're out of your mind, cop.
Give it up, Bishop. Now, come on, throw that gun out.
I'm going out, cop. You try to stop me, I'll blow your head off.
You all right, Joe?
Yeah.
How is he?
No, I better call an ambulance.
Yeah. What's that fill out of his pocket?
Wait a minute. Something he'll never use.
Yeah?
Airplane ticket to Phoenix.
Albert Martin Kruger, Harold Nelson Bishop, Thomas Nagel Leahy, and Charles Everett Lee were taken into custody and brought to trial for 2 counts of robbery in the first degree. They were convicted and received sentence as prescribed by law. Robbery in the first degree is punishable by imprisonment in the state penitentiary for a period of not less than 5 years. Because of his previous record, Thomas Nagel Leahy was given the maximum sentence and is now serving life imprisonment in the state penitentiary, Folsom, California.
Dragnet is a presentation of the United States Armed Forces Radio Service.
When you get to the corner of Smith and Orchard, you're going to want to take a
you
left.
You are not going to
then what you're
going to
do is turn onto Marcy
Avenue.
Marcy
just broke up.
And go past the first three
she's
lights
happy about
and then
it.
Take the next left.
I don't really
then
think she's
more
happy,
blocks,
but
you should be there.
Who am I to judge, right?
Park
anyway,
on the right.
That's
I'll
what
see
I
you
heard
later
last
tonight.
Night.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text. Stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Thank you, lads, and thank you, Ad Council, for that FCC obligation. My name is Arthur, and this is the Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. For the first half of the program, I played Jack Webb in his original production of Dragnet. I'm not sure what number episode this was, because as you heard, it was part of the Armed Forces Radio Service, which I've been looking into. I guess they printed these pre-recorded shows on vinyl and shipped them out, thousands of them all over the world. This probably would have been about the time of Korea. Those long leads of music presumably would be for the disc jockeys that played them to the troops. But anyway, that was The Big Flight with an original air date of the 17th of November, 1953. This is another Jack Webb, little-known gem that I discovered over the weekend. This one's titled Pete Kelly's Blues, starring Jack Webb. He didn't write these, but he produced them. This one's titled Little Jake. This had an original air date of the 25th of July, 1957. Thanks for listening.
This one's about Pete Kelly. It's about the world he goes around in. It's about the big music and the big trouble and the big 20s. So when they ask you, tell them this one's about the blues. Pete Kelly's Blues.
Pete Kelly's Blues, starring Jack Webb, with story by Jim Moser and music by Dick Cathcart.
My name's Pete Kelly. I play cornet. You'll find us at 417 Cherry Street, Kansas City. It's a standard speakeasy. We got 35 cases of cut whiskey and a 7-piece band. We start every night at 10 and we play till 6 in the morning. It's not much, but the contract runs out in June 1924. After that, there's a place in South Chicago that may take us. In the meantime, we're working here on Cherry Street. The lease is made out to George Lupo. His brother gave it to him after the funeral. The kind of music we play started out as a backroom exercise in a little swamp stop called Myrtle Grove. LaRocca took his Dixieland band to Reisenweber's in New York. We got as far as Kansas City. It's no place to get off a train unless you're a sack of mail. Because around here, everybody works at the same job, staying alive. Half a buck buys a pair of socks, a spaghetti dinner, or a down payment on murder. Well, last night, everything turned sour about midnight. The town was down on its hands and knees trying to crawl through one of those Kansas City hot spells that blast by every third day. It was heat and headaches all the way. Our drummer Nick was dragging the beat and I went bad 12 bars in on the Memphis Blues. Well, I figured we better cut the set short, so we started to fight our way through one chorus of Roses of Picardy. That's when the kid came in and stood by the bandstand. He was tall enough to see over a quart of milk with a face the size of a minute and just about as young.
All right, let's get off for a while.
Who's your friend, Pete?
I don't know, but he must be tone deaf.
Hey, Mr. Kelly, Mr. Kelly.
Yeah, son?
I heard you play. You sound good.
We've been better. What's on your mind?
Father Cronin sent me to see you.
Are you doing a little missionary work?
Oh, no, sir, nothing like that. I'm an altar boy over there. Father calls me Little Jake.
I sure got you working the late shift.
I've been trying to get a hold of you all day. Father wants a favor.
Well, make it a small one. I'm all out of the big ones.
He just wanted to know if you could come by St. Timothy's and see him. He said tomorrow morning right after the 9 o'clock.
Okay. Tell him he keeps terrible hours. I'll be there.
Well, thanks, Mr. Kelly.
Hey, Kelly.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell the kid goodbye.
He knows his way out.
Should I go, Mr. Kelly?
Beat it, kid.
Yes, sir. Goodbye, Mr. Kelly.
Yeah, goodbye, Jake.
You got someplace private we'd like to talk?
This is my office.
Now listen hard, Bright Eyes. There's enough gun in this coat to blow you right through the wall.
I'll take your word for it.
We come in here nice and you get funny mouth.
Now you got someplace we can talk.
I can't leave. I gotta do a number.
Do it.
We'll be right here about 10 feet from your stomach.
Yeah. All right. Let's go.
You look sick, Pete. What's the matter?
I feel fine. Who's sorry now? Everybody ready? Let's go.
You proved it. Now let's go.
Yeah. Keep them going, Red.
How many shall we do, Pete?
If this works out, about 10 minutes worth. Let's go.
Hey, Ollie will do. We need a favor, Kelly.
Yeah, there's a run on them tonight.
Give me the envelope, Dix.
Yeah.
You got an inside coat pocket, Kelly?
Come on, come on. Either throw or pass the dice.
Hold him, Dix. Pull him up, Dix.
Come on. Up.
Yeah. Now, this is how. Here's an envelope. It goes in your inside coat pocket, and it stays there until 6 o'clock tomorrow night. You don't open it. You don't mess with it.
What happens at 6 o'clock?
You'll be the first to know.
Well, I stood there in the alley and watched him walk away. Inside, Lupo was blowing up a storm. Something about paying for a 7-piece band and only having 6. Well, it wasn't worth trying to get back on the stand. I got a cab and went up to my room. I tried to get to sleep. It was no good. I got up. I was sick to my stomach. After that, I went to sleep. The next morning, I made a pass at some breakfast and tried to look through the sports page. Harry Heilman got 4 for 5 against the Red Sox, but that's all I read. That envelope had me. People have been taken out in alleys before, and they've been worked over. Usually, they get something away from them, not to give it to them. No matter how I tried to put it together, it wouldn't come out. Thin or fat, it wouldn't slice. I had the envelope, and I had to wait till 6 o'clock. Well, I gave up on the coffee, and I started over to see Father Cronin. It was a little after 9:30 when I started up the steps of St. Timothy's. I figured Mass was almost over, so I hung around in the vestibule for a couple of minutes, trying to look like a part-time bell ringer.
Hi, Mr. Kelly.
Hello, Jake.
Father's back in the sacristy, Mr. Kelly. He said for me to show you the way.
They move it?
No, sir.
All right, Jake, show me the way.
This way, Mr. Kelly. Down this aisle.
I guess I was too busy trying to act like I knew my way around to pay much attention to a fat, chunky little guy wearing a brown Borsellino hat. He stood up in a back pew a couple of aisles over. The church was empty except for the three of us. Little Jake found out about it just before I did.
Mr. Kelly, that man back there.
All right, mister. I'll take that envelope.
Jake, get down.
Mr. Kelly, look out! Look out!
In Kansas City, you learn early to look for trouble, any place, any time, but this is the first time it caught up with me in the middle of a church. The last 3 shots were a waste of money. Jake went down like young wheat in a hailstorm. When I grabbed for him, I hit my head on the base of a marble pillar. I lost the edge right there. By the time I hit the street, he was gone. I guess I covered every alley and street in the neighborhood, but it was like trying to wash a pail of dirty water. I don't know how much later it was when I stopped for a minute in an empty doorway and tried to remember what I was chasing. Well, a siren was crying off somewhere in the distance, and I started back for the church. The coroner's wagon was just pulling away as I got there. I didn't see Father Cronin around, so I went back to the rectory and rang the bell. He came to the door in his shirt sleeves. He stood there for a minute just looking at me. Then he motioned me inside.
In here. Sit down.
The kid, Father? Little Jake?
He's dead. You want to blow by blow?
Yeah, I know, Father. I was there.
Sure you were there. You're always there. I should have known better than to call you. I should have known it meant trouble.
Oh, wait a minute, Father. This wasn't my party.
I called you here today to ask you a favor, Pete.
Yeah, I know.
You don't know. It's too late now. We were going to have an altar boys picnic tomorrow at Washington Park. I wanted you to play a little music for us. We won't be going now, Pete. We got a funeral instead.
Yeah. What do you want me to say?
Don't say anything, Pete. If you've got any private fights, that's your business. But don't bring your beefs into the church.
I never saw the guy before, Father.
Don't kid me. He didn't come in here to shoot little Jake.
Now, look, I know this is hard to understand.
You bet it's hard to understand. We've been over it before, but you ran with the same pack. You hung on to the same friends. You had it all figured out. Well, you figured this one, Pete. There's a 9-year-old boy on his way to the morgue. He took a gangster's bullet that you earned. Now you go ahead. Figure it.
I got this envelope.
I don't want an explanation. Take your excuses and peddle them where you need them. To the bootleggers and the gunmen. Take them to your crowd.
It's this envelope, Father. They shoved it in my pocket. I was out in the alley behind the club. 2 guys. They worked me over. I didn't think they'd try anything like this.
Neither did little Jake.
All right, Father. I told you I was sorry.
Go on home.
Why don't you stop cutting at me and say a prayer for that kid?
I would, but I'm too busy praying for people like you.
Well, you couldn't blame him. How do you explain away a dead kid lying in front of an altar rail? All I could offer was a 2-cent envelope in my coat pocket and a wild night in an alley. I started to walk back to my room. I tried to paste up some kind of an answer, but I got nothing. I was halfway home when the last breeze left town and went someplace to cool off. My clothes were soaking wet, and I decided to take a cab the rest of the way. I reached in my pocket, and all I had was 23 cents, so I kept walking. Sunday morning's the same in any town. Empty streets and everybody home trading the comic section and living off a Saturday night. You could live here all your life, and on Sunday morning you just got in town. It was about noon when I got to my hotel. I went up to the second floor and unlocked my door. They were sitting on the bed. Their coats were off, and they'd hung them on the back of a chair. The same 2 boys who'd given me the envelope last night.
Got a real hot room here, Kelly. You ought to move off this court.
Yeah, next time I'll get twin beds.
Is everything all right with that envelope?
It made a murder, mister. You take it.
Put it back in your pocket.
Now get this, both of you. There's a lot of something wrong here. I've had my turn. You find yourself another fall guy. There's a lot of inside coat pockets in this town. Look for a new one.
We like yours, and that's where it's going to stay. Now, you don't listen good. Me and Dex put it out last night, and you didn't pick up on it. We got you on board, and we'll tell you when to get off.
6 o'clock, boy.
How long do you think this jag will last? Look, I'm cashing in. I've had enough.
What were you doing this morning, trying to pray your way out?
A priest wanted a favor.
I got it, Lum.
Yeah. Yeah, he's here. No, he's busy. Room 205. Sure, come on up. Benny.
He went for it, huh?
On his way up. We're going to stay a while, Kelly.
Well, there's only 3 chairs. I'll make it easy for you.
Stay put, mister.
No, he's your friend. I'm checking out.
It's the first time you've been right.
Well, it happened so fast I didn't even see his arm move. My knees buckled and I pitched forward. I don't know how long I laid there, but when I opened my eyes, the afternoon sun was almost gone. What was left of it was bleeding through a rip in the blind. Well, I could hear somebody breathing hard like a fat man on a hot day, and when I rolled over, I saw him. A tough prohibition agent by the name of Cage. The weather didn't make any difference to Cage. He always looked that way. His collar was wilted, and it looked like Arrow's first try. His necktie was pulled down, and the knot was twisted. The heat had worked him over so that the front of his shirt was splotchy and damp. Reminded you of a first grader's map of the world. He was sitting in a chair with his arms draped over the back and his head resting on his hands. He was smoking a Milo Violet, but it didn't help that much. His mouth was wound around a toothy grin, and he looked like a mountain lion who'd just eaten her young.
You can get up now, Keller. You made your point.
Yeah, sure. How long you been here?
Long enough to fill out your book and slip. You're going to jail, mister.
What for? Sleeping on the floor?
For the dead guy on the bed. Who is he?
I don't know. How'd he get there?
You put him there after you shot him. Now get your hat.
Look, prohibition's your racket. Dead bodies are out of your line.
Not when I find him in your room. Now let's go downtown. We'll both tell homicide. We'll find the details later.
Cage, you couldn't find yourself in a mirror. I didn't have anything to do with this, and you know it. I've been out for the last 3 hours. This happened after they slugged
me. Save it for the jury. All I know is I got a phone tip to check room 205. I come up here and I find you and a dead guy. That's all I need. You can dress it up fancy and make it look cute, but it's still comes out murder.
There's enough liquor in this town to float it away, and you're wasting your time with a killing that's none of your business.
You're my business, big shot. Somebody put 2 pounds of lead in Benny's chest, and you're my pick.
Benny who?
Benny Davis. He worked for Mike Quinlan. You look pale.
Yeah, I'm just beginning to feel the squeeze. Mike Quinlan on one side and those 2 trigger men that you let walk out of here on the other.
You got it, and I'll be turning the handle.
Now, before you start worrying about your picture in the paper, you better turn up the 2 guys that were here with me.
That part of the same dream?
They gave me an envelope to hold for him. The price on it's going up with a minute. A 9-year-old kid died for it, and this guy here on the bed.
That's a good story. Do you write him down or just make him up?
Look, you got nothing on me, and I haven't got much time. I'm leaving you.
That's all right. I call downtown. The minute you hit the street, they'll pick you up.
In the meantime, you better come up with more than you got. They don't hang you in this state on a hunch.
I'm gonna check this room over. I'll find all we need.
You couldn't find your head with both hands. Goodbye, Cage.
All right, you got till midnight, big shot, and then I'll be around.
Yeah.
I'll have it all set up. All we'll need is time to run the extra.
Well, I could have used a cold shower, but with Cage there, I didn't have the room to dry off. I went down the hall and headed down the back stairs. I figured even if Cage was right about calling downtown, I might have an edge if I moved fast enough. The sun was on the downgrade, but it didn't make any difference. It'd done a good job all day, and the heat was boiling up out of the ground. Well, if I was going to come out at all, I had to have some help. So I started to look for the only honest guy I know, an ex-bootlegger by the name of Barney Ricketts, the only bootlegger in the country that went broke in 1922. He drank himself out of business. I phoned 8 different places and tried 4. Nobody'd seen him. I was about ready to give up when I finally found him sitting in the middle of a bourbon fog in a little Spanish joint somewhere on the edge of the East Bottoms. He was sitting at a back table trying his best to make time with a plaster bust of Queen Isabella.
Ah, Peachy, my boy, you're just in time. I'm not quite certain, but I think the young lady here has a friend.
I gotta talk to you, Barney.
If you're any good at all with Spanish, now's the time. I was positive she'd loosen up on the second bottle of wine, but no, she's utterly uncharitable, and I think she's a picture of a perfect boy.
Yeah, all right, Barney.
Maybe to a member of the old Castilian school, there can be no excuse for the conduct she's exhibiting.
Yeah.
Why, do you know I was even good enough to buy her 3 rounds of Portuguese brandy? Imported, mind you. But what do I get for my pains? Not even a civil thank you.
All right, listen to me, will you, Barney?
I've been sitting here in a most gentlemanly fashion, sipping this delicate nectar and trying vainly to keep the party going. But does she help? No. I've talked to her about politics, medicine, literature, Keats, Byron, Shelley, Faith Baldwin. I've even talked about the weather.
Barney, she's a statue.
Oh, a simple oversight, Petey. It could happen to anyone.
Now, look, I'm in trouble.
Of course you're in trouble. You'll always be in trouble because you're a child of adversity, a son of scorn. The fate spit in your eye and you try to retaliate, but the wind's always blowing in the wrong direction. You're a lost leaf in the mortal storm, Petey. You're a pebble shaking a tiny fist at the mountain. You'd like to fight for some strange, fantastic cause, wouldn't you? But you can't find anybody your size. Men are too small and the gods are too big. Petey, you're lost.
You all through now?
Yes, what kind of trouble?
A pair of bum murder raps. Somebody slugged me in my room and I woke up with a dead guy.
Dubious honor. You mentioned two murders.
One of them was an altar boy over at St. Timothy's. The other guy worked for Mike Quinlan.
The same Quinlan that controls most of the Canadian import here in town?
Yeah, that's him.
Oh, time's short. Let's finish the brandy.
Two guys started all this at the club last night. Names are Ludd and Dex. Mean anything to you?
This'll all sound better with more brandy. You picked two of Quinlan's first string. Ludd Sandell and Dex Porter, both killers.
Look, they gave me an envelope to hang on to. Now nose around. See if you can find out what it all means. The dead guy up in my room, his name's Benny Davis. See if you can find out where he fits in, will you?
It'd be a lot simpler if you just joined Quinlan's gang. Benny Davis holds a card in the same organization.
Well, how about Ludd and Dex? Any bad blood between them and
if
Davis?
If there is, it doesn't show. They're closer than unborn peas.
You sure about that, Barney?
Police blotter can't be that wrong. Benny's sister will tell you the same thing.
Well, where do I find her?
Chelsea Apartments. Beautiful girl, Petey. When you're my age, she'll disturb your memories.
All right, now get going, will you? See how close you can get to Quinlan's headquarters. Find out what you can about Ludd and Dex and Benny Davis. Maybe Quinlan's got him on a special job or something. Find out what it is, will you?
You find me in a temporary economic slump, Petey. I'll need car fare.
Yeah, well, that makes two of us. I'm broke. You'll have to do it on foot.
Oh, well, I have friends here, and my credit's unlimited.
Well, hurry up, will you, Barney?
One moment. Alfonso, would you loan me a dollar and a half?
Come on, let's go.
He's only bluffing. He won't shoot.
Well, Barney headed down toward Bale Street for Mike Quinlan's place, and I started cross town for the North End and the Chelsea Apartments. I couldn't begin to work it out. If Dex and Ludd were such good friends with Benny Davis, why did they kill him? And if they didn't do it, who planted his body in my room and why? Well, I was running way late, and there wasn't much time to catch up. I finally found the Chelsea Apartments on the corner of Stocker and Bales. It was an old three-story wooden frame. I checked the mailbox, and Louise Davis was down for apartment 17. Well, inside, the hallway was dark, and a couple of gas jets were smoking up the ceiling. There was a potted palm by the foot of the stairs, and it looked like it was growing out of old gum wrappers and cigar butts. Apartment 17 was at the rear of the first floor. She answered the door, and you could tell right away Barney was right. She was pretty, and she had enough smile to last you for years.
Yes?
You Louise Davis?
That's right. I can do better for you. You're Pete Kelly. I've heard you play.
Yeah, well, so far you're batting 1,000. Can I come in?
Yeah, sure. You didn't bring your band, so it must be a social call.
I'll make this short. It's about Benny.
What about him?
That's what I want to know. He's got a couple of friends. I got to know about him.
Then he isn't that popular. You mean Ludd and Dex?
They'll do. They got trouble, and they're cutting me in.
What kind of trouble?
Well, I'm not sure. That's why I came to you.
I can't help you. They never tell me what they're doing.
Well, they gave me an envelope. They told me to hold it till 6 o'clock tonight.
You haven't got any problem. You'll know in an hour.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm tired. I want to know now. I'll take any lead you got.
They found out I told you this. They might not like it. They got some kind of a beef with Quinlan.
Does Mike know about it?
I wouldn't know. I just heard him talking one night. They're not happy with the money Quinlan gives them.
They got any plans?
I don't think we better talk about this. Let me get you a drink, huh?
Now, look, this is the last trip around for me, lady. I got to have everything you know.
You said something about an envelope, didn't you?
That's right.
You got it?
Right here.
If you open it, you'll understand everything.
Well, they gave it to me sealed. They want it back the same way.
If you want to be around to give it back, you'd better open it.
You got a guarantee handy?
All I know is the three of them are working on something big. I don't know what it is, but I heard some talk about an envelope. It's your choice. You ask for a lead and you got it.
Yeah, we'll hold hands when they cut me down. You got a letter opener?
Pete, look out!
Well, it all happened faster than a Mexican divorce. Louise Davis was dead before the echo left the room. Well, I got to the window, but whoever did the shooting was gone. I grabbed the envelope, and on my way out, I took another look at her. There wasn't anything left but the smile. I cut through a couple of back lots and down an alley. I stopped in a doorway and opened the envelope. Inside was a handful of typewritten sheets. Looked like a lot of headache for five pieces of paper. And then the bell rang. Two of them were consignment slips for 8,000 gallons of high-grade Canadian whiskey. The other three slips were detailed breakdowns for a convoy of trucks. They showed special truck routes over the Canadian border into the States to miss the hijackers and the prohibition agents. They showed a day-by-day schedule for each truck on its trip down from the border. Well, it's not too tough to hijack a load of booze, but when you got it laid out right down to the time, the place, and how many bottles, it's like money in the bank. Well, I knew right then why the envelope meant so much to Ludd and Dex. What I couldn't understand was where they got it. why they gave it to me to hang on to. Well, maybe they were working for Quinlan, but why didn't he have the papers, and why weren't they in his safe? Mike had a big one. Well, the questions were still piling up. It was an outside chance, but I couldn't stand still, so I crossed over to the Kansas side and headed down Boulder Road to Fat Annie's place. Maggie Jackson did two things good. She sang the blues better than the guy who wrote them, and she could pick up an idle rumor at 3 miles.
Hi, Pete.
Maggie, what do you know?
I knew you'd be here tonight. You always come in together. Trouble and Pete Kelly.
Yeah, I know. I never come around except when I need something.
As long as I have it to give, you got it. It's Mike Quinlan this time, ain't it?
Well, that's part of it. I'm in it up to my ears.
You got an envelope, I heard.
Yeah.
Mike Quinlan and some of his boys have been here about an hour ago. They tore the paper off the walls looking for you and Dex and Ludd.
Dex and Ludd?
Mike wants all three of you.
Yeah, anything else?
No. Barney Ricketts called for you.
Did he leave a number?
He's still waiting on the phone. I took the call. He said you'd end up here, so he just hung on.
Well, I'll get it right now.
Yeah, the boss is kind of mad. The phone's been tied up for 2 hours.
All right, thanks, Maggie.
Sure, and good luck, Pete.
Hello, Barney.
There you are, Petey.
That'll be $1.25 for another 3 minutes.
Yes, all right, operator. Alfonso, 5 more quarters, please. No, the quarters. Just a minute, Petey. Alfonso doesn't know the quarters from the house.
Yeah, well, hurry up.
Thank you.
Now then, Pete. No, Alfonso, no more money for the moment.
What's going on, Barney? Where are you?
Fort Madison, Iowa. I'm troubleshooting for you, Pete.
What'd you find out?
It's a double cross. Mike Quinlan's involved in one of the biggest deals of his career, and Benny Davis, along with Dex and Ludd, stole the consignment papers.
Yeah, I know. That's what's in the envelope.
You better get them back to Quinlan. I understand he's been tearing up the town for them.
Well, what do I do about Dex and Ludd?
She might easily end up like Benny Davis. Seems Ludd and Dex didn't want to split it 3 ways, so they killed him.
You sure about all this?
That's why I'm up here in Iowa. I suggest that you join us.
No, I'll see you when you get back.
It's been a gay, mad world, Petey. We drove 60 miles an hour all the way up here.
Yeah?
Alfonso's drunk. He thinks the phone's a slot machine. He's waiting for the payoff.
Well, as soon as I hung up the phone, everything fell into place. I had one big worry, to get back to the club and unload those papers before Quinlan caught up with me. Well, almost everything made sense now, except the killing of Louise Davis, Benny's sister. It was easy to see why they dropped Benny along the way, but why his sister? How did she tie in? Well, on the way back to town, I mulled over a couple of possibilities, and I figured maybe I came up with the answer. I started back for town, and it was rough all the way. I kept thinking any minute I'd bump into Mike Quinlan, and I couldn't be sure that I'd lost Dex and Ludd. It was almost dark by the time I got back to the club. The band was waiting around for the Sunday rehearsal. We ran through one number, and then things got cloudy.
Now, Kelly.
You're early, Dex.
Close enough.
No, not for me. You said 6 o'clock.
Your horn's no match for this gun. Give me the envelope.
6 o'clock, Dex. All right. Let's try someday, sweetheart. Hand me that plunger, will you, Red? I'll give you the pickup.
Thank you.
All right. You can pack up. I'll see you at 10.
You gonna give me that envelope or do I blow it out of your pocket?
The same way you handled Louise Davis?
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you do. You killed her and you killed her brother.
You got it all figured out, haven't you, Kelly?
The horn player's right, Dex. Don't turn around.
You got it wrong, Lud.
I don't think so. I never should have let you kill Benny. That should have been the tip-off on that kid in the church and Benny's sister. You had to make the big try.
It was for me and you, Lud.
It won't wash. You're gonna die, Dex. Pick a spot to lay down.
Not in the back, Lud. You'd give me a better chance than that.
Would I?
Look out, Lud!
Like I said, Dex, pick a spot! Well, that wraps it up, Kelly.
You better sit down, Lud.
No, this'll do. It won't be a long wait. I don't mind standing.
Suit yourself. 6 o'clock, Lud. Here's your envelope.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Hello, Pete.
Hi, Father.
Just gonna stop by. I heard the gunshots. I knew you'd be around.
Well, let me tell you again, Father. I'm sorry about Jake. I don't know what else to say. I'm just sorry.
I believe you. We'll have the funeral for little Jake tomorrow. Maybe you want to stop by.
Yeah. Some things never figure. A 9-year-old kid shot down. No reason for it. None in the world. 9-year-old kid.
It's done, Pete. Don't waste your pity on little Jake. He's got a big lead on both of us.
I don't get you, Father.
You and I should die as good as a 9-year-old.
Pete Kelly's Blues, starring Jack Webb, with story by Jim Moser and music by Dick Cathcart. Scoring by Matty Matlock.
The music of Pete Kelly's Big Seven consists of Dick Cathcart on cornet, Matty Matlock on clarinet, Nick Fatool on drums, Ray Sherman on piano, George Van Epps on guitar, Judd Donat on bass, Mo Schneider on trombone. The songs of Maggie Jackson were written by Arthur Hamilton. Pete Kelly's Blues is a presentation of the United States Armed Forces Radio Service.
That was Pete Kelly's Blues, titled Little Jake, with an original air date of the 25th of July, 1957. Again, starring Jack Webb. Today has been a Jack Webb double feature, and I found Pete Kelly's Blues over the weekend, which I found pretty interesting, although albeit a little more morose. My name is Arthur, and you've been listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. Thanks for listening.